Unity. Unity is one of the most elusive goals known to mankind. People are constantly pursuing that. You look down through history, you know, people have tried to achieve unity. If you really boil it down, there are probably three different ways of thinking about unity. There's the passive way, which is, yeah, unity's good, but someone else needs to engineer it and make it happen. I'm just going to kind of sit here passively. That's one way. You know, events will force unity to happen. You know, that's one way of thinking about it. A second way of thinking about it is an opportunistic way, which says, I'm going to wait for opportunities and I'm going to do what I can to promote unity in those opportunities. You know, fair enough. That's another possible way of thinking about what's your personal reaction to this elusive goal of unity, an opportunistic way you take towards it. So I'm going to wait for opportunities and then I'm going to do something. A third way is an active, a proactive, a deliberate way of addressing unity. A deliberate, active pursuit of unity. Today I'd like to ask us to ask ourselves, each of us individually, what is our stance towards it? What is our stance towards unity? Are we passive? Are we opportunistic? Or are we really going out of our way proactively to promote unity every day, in every interaction that we have? Why is it so important? Well, let's turn to Revelation. Let's turn to the end of the book and see what we're aiming to achieve. Revelation 19 and verse 6-7. These two verses are really some of my most favorite verses in the Bible because it represents the end of this age. It represents the goal to which we're all striving. So Revelation 19, verse 6-7. And I heard, as it were, a voice of great sound as many waters, saying, Hallelujah, for the Lord God omnipotent reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory. Now notice this, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. That last phrase, his wife has made herself ready, has a lot that speaks of unity. It just full of it. Let's break it down. Let's unpack that a little bit more. We know that the church is the bride, right? The church is the bride. We are part of the body of Christ. We're being prepared now to meet him. Some of the key characteristics of this bride are given to us in that little phrase. The first characteristic is, it's singular. His bride. It doesn't say brides. It says bride. Singular. What does that, imply unity, doesn't it? His bride has made herself ready. She has made herself ready. That's the second key point. You know, think about the weddings, maybe your own wedding that you've experienced. Maybe weddings that you've gone to and you've seen and you've been familiar with all the preparation that's gone in for that wedding. All the work that the bride has put in. She's got a whole team of people around her that she's, you know, engaged in trying to make sure that on that day, she's ready. Was she being passive? Was she saying, oh, I'll kind of wait, I'll just be opportunistic about it. Oh yeah, it looks like a nice day today, maybe I'll go out and start doing the wedding preparation. No, she's urgent about it. She's full of enthusiasm every day. She's can hardly passionate about getting it done. She's proactive in the fullest sense of the word about getting ready. And she's made herself ready. She's in control of that whole story. You know, not even mother is able to say, no, no, mom, take a back seat. This is my wedding. You know, the bride's in the driver's seat, proactive, pursuing readiness. So here we have a unified situation which has been proactively prepared for. It starts, brethren, unity starts at an individual level. We can't say, oh, well, we'll wait for unity to come down from, you know, from the top of the organization or from the head of the family or from, you know, starting at the top. Or even, you know, in our country, in our nation, we can't say, okay, unity is going to have to come from the top. It starts individually with each of us. What are we doing to be a promoter, an active promoter, an active pursuer of unity? It all comes down to relationships, doesn't it? My relationships in my family, my relationships in my community, in the neighborhood in which we live, my relationships with the people I work with, my relationships in the church, in this congregation, in the other congregations within the United Church of God, and in the other Church of God congregations beyond the United Church of God. What is my relationship with those people? With my fellow human beings. That's what it comes down to. Even strangers that you walk into, you're in a store and you're buying something. What's my relationship with this stranger person that I've met? You know, am I promoting unity? Now, before I go any further, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page here about something. I'm not here trying to make some big statement that the churches have to come together under one banner and join one organization. I'm not saying that, so please put that out of your mind. This is not a sermon urging everyone to join a particular church group. It's not what I'm talking about. I am saying, though, that from a relationship perspective, no matter where people are, we've got to concentrate on promoting unity. We've got to concentrate on promoting unity. And just as in the first sermon today, we heard about communication, and we heard it's a big topic. Unity, guess what, is a big topic. So we're addressing two big topics, but I think you'll see there's a silver thread running through the two messages today. There's a silver thread, because the way we communicate with each other is fundamental to building strong relationships. How we communicate with each other is fundamental, and I think you'll see that as we get into this. I do want to make sure that we cover just a couple of the assumptions that we've always made. All of us have made these assumptions from time to time. And we've been involved in conversations where these things have been mentioned. And these are often people's response when we start talking about unity. People will often say, you know, we've tried that. You know, we've tried unity. But it's just so hard. And it's so elusive. And we can't do anything about it. The only thing we can do is pray about it. That's all we can do. Now, how many times have you heard that? I mean, you know, I've heard it often, and maybe I've even said it myself. But is that actually a terribly good assumption and a good way to kind of, you know, move on from this subject? All we can do is pray. Look, prayer is absolutely vital. It's one of the cornerstones of addressing this. But is that the only thing we can do? Really? We all lament a lack of unity. We all lament it. None of us want a lack of unity. It's caused so much stress in our lives over the years. If you think about it, I'm not talking just within the church, I'm talking within our neighborhoods, you know, within our country. Look at the stress that we've all been under, especially the last several years. It's been crazy, the divisiveness that's been going on. We lament it. Disunity is a horrible thing. Can you think of anyone who really wants disunity? Satan. Satan wants disunity. If you look across humanity, humans don't want disunity. They want unity. They want peace. They want everyone just wants to have a peaceful life with everyone around them. Satan is the one who hates unity. And he's going to do whatever he can to divide and conquer. The question is, you know, what can we do against this backdrop? So certainly prayer is key. We have to pray. We have to draw close to God. We have to ask him to give us wisdom in our communication with each other. You know, how do we interact? Because remember, the whole thing is at the individual level, you know, at the individual level, how do we interact with other people? How do we build our relationships with them? You know, in thinking about this whole topic, it reminded me of some research that I did a few years ago. I was looking at some of the indigenous tribes in Africa, especially down in the southern part of Africa, and I came across a tribe called the Gorana tribe, G-O-R-A-N-A, Gorana tribe. They had broken away from a larger tribe called the Khoikhoi. Probably heard about them. They're a bit more famous. Now, the head of the Gorana tribe was a chap by the name of Gora. So go figure, Gora and Gorana. He'd had a big quarrel with the leaders of the Khoikhoi, and he decided he was going to break away, form his own tribe. Now, Gorana means the real thing. that's the direct translation. So you see, what he had was he had pride, right? He said, the Khoikhoi are not the real thing. I'm the real thing. And my tribe's name is Gorana, which means the real thing. So you can see where that mindset was, right? Now, think about, where did that lead? What was the next step in that particular tribe's development? Well, you probably guessed it. His sons couldn't get along with each other, and they decided they were going to splinter out and create their own tribes. And you had the great Gorana and the little Gorana. the great real thing and the little real thing. And, you know, if you follow what happened next, they split. And then they split. And guess what happened? The Gorana, the real thing, disappeared. They just disappeared. So the opposite of unity is disunity. It's splintering, it's breaking up in the family, you know, within the church, within your neighborhood, within the nation, within the globe, within the world, within humanity. That's what happens. That's what happens. It's a sad humanity. It's human. It's left to ourselves. That's what we do. And it's perfect for Satan. It's exactly what he wants. Because what does he want more than anything else? He wants to see the people of God at loggerheads. He wants to see us splinter and splinter and splinter and splinter and splinter and disappear. That's what he wants. He's at war, brethren. We can see the side of evil of the last several years. He's on the warpath, and this is one of his key weapons, is to create disunity. You know, when you think of unity and disunity, another word immediately comes to mind, and that word is conflict. Conflict. See, Goro was having conflict with the leaders of the Khoikhoi. And then his underlings had conflict with each other, and then they had conflicts of conflicts and conflicts, and then they disappeared. So, what can we learn about conflict? What is the essence behind conflict? And it's important to think about this from two perspectives. There are two terms very often used in leadership and management, etc. Where they talk about conflict resolution, and then they talk about conflict management. Two different approaches to conflict. Conflict resolution, conflict management. Now, conflict resolution assumes that you can stop conflict, and that differences of opinion, etc., must be stamped out. There's only one way that we need to step forward together, locked arm in arm. And, you know, any dissenters need to be crushed, essentially, or persuaded very, vociferously and eventually moved out if they do not comply. So that's conflict resolution. That's one way of thinking about it. The other way is to look at conflict management. Conflict management says, actually, let's replace the word conflict. Let's think about it differently. Let's just think about it in terms of differences of perspective. Differences. And let's, instead of thinking about differences as being bad, let's think about differences as being good. You know, we're all created by the same Creator, and we're all different. Every single one of us, just like every snowflake that falls out of the sky in parts of the world that get snow, and hopefully we don't get any this season, but maybe we will, who knows. But every snowflake that falls out of the sky is unique, just the same. Every human being is completely unique. We all see things differently. We all have different perspectives. Denise and I have been married for 44 years. We see the same event, and she sees it one way, and I see it another way. We've got different perspectives. Every one of us. Are those differences wrong? No, they're great, because when we communicate, when we discuss them, we both learn. We both see, wow, I didn't think of that. That's, wow, Thank you for sharing your perspective. Very interesting. If we think of resolution versus management, resolution, conflict resolution sets us up for a very rough ride, a very difficult journey. Whereas conflict management sets us up for an opportunity to learn together, to get better at this thing called life. To learn and to gain knowledge from each other. And that rings a bell, doesn't it? In 2 Peter, let's turn over to 2 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3. And let's see. Verse 18. 2 Peter 3, verse 18. Right at the end of this book, it says, "But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To him be glory both now and to the day of eternity. Amen." Growing in grace and knowledge. Through the way that we communicate with each other, through the way that we interact with each other and build our relationships up, and extend grace towards each other, we learn. We gain knowledge. It's a real opportunity that we have every day to do that. Let's actively be watching out for those opportunities. Let's actively try and create those opportunities. When we see that we're interacting with someone and we notice, there's something not right, that person's not looking that happy with that interaction you just happened, stop. Think about what you've just said. Think about where that person may be coming from. Change the dialogue. Look for an opportunity to hear what they're thinking. Learn to understand, seek to understand them first before you try and force your understanding or your perspective on them. Always seek to understand first. It's to understand the other person. Now, there's an article in United Church of God's Vertical Thought magazine of December 2005, so it goes back some time, but it's a really good article. It was called Win-Win. And the subtitle was, "Who Says There Has to Be a Loser?" Win-win. Who says there has to be a loser? And I'm going to quote a couple of key pieces out of the article, because I think it's really apropos to what we're discussing here. It's very realistic. So here goes. So it's about these two girls, Dawn and Pam. They were both good basketball players, good enough to make the varsity team in their sophomore year. They were good friends until Dawn started hitting 4 or 5 shots a game and getting more attention. Wow. Can imagine what that did to Pam. Here's my best buddy getting more attention. Whether consciously or unconsciously, Pam became resentful and stopped passing to Dawn. So here they are, both good friends, and now you see this rift. And the team that was united and was doing well, now all of a sudden the team is starting to, dare I say, splinter. Cracks are forming. Sometimes it seems like it's all about winners and losers in sports, in business, in reality TV, even in school. Sean Covey, the author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective Teens, that is teenagers, wrote a book in 1998 in which he really got into this topic. And his father, Stephen Covey, is probably a little bit more well known to most people. He has the Seven Habits of Successful People. The two of them together came up with this problem-solving technique called win-win. And Sean Covey compares life to an all-you-can-eat buffet. No one has to go hungry. No one has to be a loser. And that's what he promotes. Now, this article in Vertical Thought magazine quotes a little bit from that book. But back into the story, the two girls, Dawn and Pam, after playing a terrible game in which Pam kept the ball most of the time, Dawn says I was mad as I had ever been. I spent many hours talking with my dad, going over everything and expressing my anger towards my friend, who's turned enemy. After a long discussion with my dad told me the best thing he could think of would be for me to give the ball every time you get it, give it to her. I thought it was the most stupid suggestion he'd ever come up with. The next game came quickly. I was determined to beat Pam at her own game. I planned and plotted and came out with a mission to ruin her game. On my first possession of the ball, I heard my dad above the crowd, "Give her the ball!" I hesitated 1 second, and then I did what I knew was right. Pam was shocked, but not too shocked to sink the basket. Dawn felt good and kept it up through the game, only shooting if the play called for her to shoot or if she was wide open. We won the game. And in the game, she began to pass me the ball as much as I passed her the ball. Interesting story, isn't it? It's real. It actually happened. But it just goes to show, it starts with relationships. It started with the relationship of these two people in the team. And it made the team a united force to be reckoned with. They were winning game after game after game because their relationship was right. We do want everyone to win. Most of us, most human beings really want that, a win-win. When our family, our friends, our coworkers, our classmates are involved in some way, we do want them to win. But Satan broadcasts those messages, doesn't he, all the time. He's broadcasting, it's not fair. Why should they be in the limelight? You should be there. And why is that? That's because his character is that way. We can see how he decided that he was going to be better than God. He was going to attack the throne of God. It's not fair that God should have all the glory. Look at what he was doing. He was Lucifer. He was gorgeous. Why aren't I getting all the attention? And his jealousy and greed led to him becoming Satan. You know, it really comes down ultimately to the golden rule, doesn't it? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's in Matthew 7, verse 12. We don't have to turn there. I think most people know Matthew 7, verse 12, the golden rule. Whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. So, do you want people to listen to you? Again, it comes to this communication thing, doesn't it? When you're involved in a communication of some type or another, you'd love it if the other person would just listen to what you've got to say. Well, start by listening to them. Because you want something, do it to them first. Listen to them. Do you want people to hear you out when you have a difference of opinion about something? Seek to understand what they're talking about first. And then they'll give you the opportunity to talk about what you're thinking about. You know, and it's not necessarily just on big things. It's on even trivial things like, how do you want to put the toilet paper? You know, this way or that way? And we all have those kinds of arguments, don't we? Why don't you put the toilet paper this way around? Okay, let me understand. Why do you say that? Oh, okay, well, that's actually a pretty good reason. I'll change. I'll do it that way. That sounds like a brilliant idea. I never thought of it before. Thank you for sharing it. The Apostle Paul also discussed this principle in Philippians 2. Let's go to Philippians 2, verse 3. Philippians 2, and verse 3. Philippians 2, verse 3, it says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself or herself. What a novel thought. What a great idea. You know, if we just humble ourselves a little bit and realize that we can probably learn something from this other person. So, you want to do to others as you would have them do to you, but you also really want to make sure that you have this humility at the base of all of your interactions, all of your communications. Now, there's an interesting study that this group called the Mediation Center of the Pacific, came up with. And it states that studies suggest that 30 to 40% of a manager's daily activities are devoted to dealing with some kind of interpersonal conflict. Go figure. Okay, so you're a manager, you're in a business, and you are spending up to 40% of your time every day dealing with interpersonal problems instead of actually moving forward and getting to the goal of what you're trying to get to as a team and getting stuff done. 40% is just getting blown up in trying to get people to be nice to each other, you know. I mean, it's fixing squabbles. It's almost like we, no matter how old we get, we're still kids, you know. It's like, stop your squabbling. You know, the kid's in the back of the car, you're driving somewhere, and the kids are squabbling. He's touching me! You know, it's like, oh, please. You know, just sort yourselves out so I can concentrate on getting us to where we need to get to. And you can help me to do that. Are we just grown-up kids sometimes? Or kids in grown-up form? As we said earlier, you know, Satan hates diversity, but God created diversity, and he wants us to learn from each other. He wants us to be kind to each other, to love each other, to learn, to grow in grace and knowledge, to be a team. Having a thought that, there's a difference. We've got to eradicate the difference. You know, we've got to resolve the conflict. Let's change our mental mindset and think about, no, let's manage the differences. Let's manage our differences. That creates a non-threatening environment as well. I think, you know, one of the things that a lot of these studies talk about is the fact that why do people react in the way that they do naturally? And it's usually because they feel threatened. They feel that there's this problem and they're the only ones that can see it from a certain perspective and no one else is listening to them. And they either get into a fight or flight mode about it. They're either going to fight and force their perspective on everyone else, or they're going to run away from it. And of course, neither of those is right, is it? You know, certainly fright, you know, is based on fear, and we should not be living by fear, we should be living by faith, the complete opposite of it. Faith in God, faith that the principles in the Bible that tell us how to interact with each other actually work, because God put them there, and He created us, and He knows that it works. So, if we follow what's there, we shouldn't have the fear. There are a number of great examples in the Bible of win-win thinking. Let's just look at one of them in particular, in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, chapter 25. 1 Samuel 25 and verse, let's read a sizable chunk here, from verse 4 through verse 13. Actually, I'll kind of summarize a little bit of it and we'll move through it as rapidly as possible. But 1 Samuel 25, verse 4 to 13. So the context is David had already been anointed king, but he was still on the run. Saul was still crazy. He's just gone nuts. And while a fugitive, David and his men had actually been protecting the flocks of a rich rancher by the name of Nabal. Nabal, N-A-B-A-L. And so now David and his men had come in. They were tired. They politely asked if the rich man would be willing to share some food with them. And the rich man rudely refused. And when David heard this, he was angry. So he went into fight mode. And the scene was set for a deadly win-lose. Because, you know, David had his band of men. And they were... You didn't mess with David and his men, put it that way. They knew how to take people out. So it would have been win for David's team, lose for Nabal. It wouldn't have been good. And of course, David was trying to resolve the conflict, wasn't he? See, you've got to see it my way, Nabal, and I'm going to force you to see it my way. Enter Abigail. Yay! Abigail comes into the picture, Nabal's wife. And she very carefully intervenes and presents a sensible plan to both David's men and Nabal's household. It's a win-win. Both of them are persuaded, both of them are satisfied, and it's a win-win. Of course, you read a little bit later that didn't end well for Nabal ultimately, right? He fell ill and he died, but that's a completely different story. But essentially, if we put the spotlight on what Abigail did, she engineered a win-win. Whereas it was going wrong very rapidly. It was going down the win-lose path. We can learn from that. We can learn from that. Now, of course, there are times where you can't get a win-win. There are times, let's face it. No matter how hard you pursue getting a win-win, because someone on the other side just wants a win-lose. They want to win. They want you to lose. So what do you do? And if you think of it just in terms of the courtrooms of humankind, every judge has a room called the evidence room. The judge has all the evidence. God the Father has all the evidence on all of our interactions with each other. He knows your perspective, he knows the other person's perspective, and he knows the real facts. And he's got the evidence of all of that in his evidence room. And if the other person wants you to lose, and they want to win, ultimately, God wins. And as long as we're right with God, we're going to get to a win-win ultimately. So we don't have to feel stressed. We've got to get to that point where we are able to force our opinion into it. We can just leave it with the judge. Leave it in the evidence room and move forward. But that's not where we start. We shouldn't start from a point of view of, this conflict or this difference of opinion is never going to get solved. The other person wants a win-lose. We shouldn't ever start addressing a relationship from that perspective. Getting back to the title of the sermon, we want to be pursuing unity. And we've got to have a mindset of really pursuing it. What's the Bible also talks about? Seek peace, pursue it earnestly. We sing it as one of the hymns in the hymnal. Seek peace, pursue it earnestly. That's not, I'm going to give up, this is too hard. That's pursue it. Back to the Mediation Center of the Pacific. The study that they did, they have 7 key points that they say, if people would just focus on these, we'd have a lot more harmony, a lot more unity. So I'm going to share those 7 points with you really briefly here. The first one is get the facts. Get the facts. Both parties should try and get the facts. Put the facts on the table. The second point is say, okay, let's all recognize that that's something that happened. We've got the facts, but it's something that happened. It's actually in the past. It's behind us. It's not happening now. There's nothing any of us can do about it. We can't change what happened. It's in the past. Put it behind us. The third point is to break down the problem into smaller parts and to find mutually beneficial agreements on these, step by step. Because usually it's this big thing. It's blown up into this massive thing. And it's, let's decompose it. Let's break it out, unpack it into all of its different little components and try and figure out creative ways of addressing those. The fourth one is for each of the little pieces, brainstorm possible solutions, accepting ideas from all parties. They come up with ideas, you come up with ideas, you list them out. The fifth step is you move to discussing it. So now you're talking about the creative ideas, the innovative ideas, how to move forward and to do better so we can all win. How can we get a win out of all of these? And usually it's this time that people really express their interests, not their positions. They're not saying, this is my position and I'm sticking to it. This is where you say, my interests are that we should both win out of this. My interests are that, and you can list a number of possible interests. Because what you want to do is to get to your yes. And there's another great book, by the way, called Getting to Yes, which unfortunately, I know I've just quoted it out of my mouth, but it's just come to my brain now. And I don't have the reference with me, but if you'd like it, I can give it to you afterwards. But it has similar kind of steps to these 7 steps here. So discussing the opportunities or the possible solutions is what happens in step 5. In step 6, this is the step to find the common ground. You say, for this particular piece of the puzzle, these suggestions have been made by you, these suggestions have been made by me. Notice they overlap in some instances. Well, let's focus on the areas where it does overlap and let's try and build a common view around those. Find the common ground. And this is especially where you want to make sure you're seeking to understand the other person's perspective before you try and force your understanding on them. The seventh step is what Covey calls synergy. And this happens when you get creative cooperation and everyone works creatively together and the results are phenomenal. When you come to a conclusion. And there's often give and take there. So rhythm, there's a lot that we can learn from managing conflict, managing our differences. In fact, the word conflict probably is best kind of replaced by the word differences. Because we're all different, we all have different perspectives, and guess what? That's good. It's only when those differences get turned by Satan into something that causes conflict that we have a problem. Prior to that, it's all good. It's a wonderful thing. So when you're tempted to throw up your arms and say, there's nothing we can do about this difference of opinion, or this conflict, or this disunity, all we can do is pray for it. Ask yourself the question, is that really true? Have I really done everything I could do to try and address this? Certainly prayer is the first step. Absolutely. Without prayer, anything you try is not going to work. But after prayer, we should really start thinking about how we're communicating with that individual. Have we established our position and we expect them to come to our position? Are we trying to resolve the conflict by forcing our perspective? Or are we managing the differences? Are we managing the differences? One more assumption that a lot of us have used, and I've been guilty of this myself, is when you see a conflict or disunity, oh, just leave it alone. Time heals all things. That assumption is so not true. It's so not true. Time doesn't heal all things. If there's an issue there, guess what happens? It becomes a root of bitterness over time. And everyone starts really feeling the pain of it. And it is not good. We need to seek peace, pursue it earnestly. So the question really comes down, brethren, should we be active or passive or simply opportunistic when it comes to unity and disunity? Should we be proactive, like the bride, readying herself? It starts at the individual level. The responsibility doesn't belong to anyone else but me and you. It starts at the individual level. It's about relationships. It's about relationships at the individual level. Relationships with God, absolutely, but relationships with fellow man. The time for unity is now.